This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, Dennis James talks with Michael Smith about their recent trip to Cuba.
Well, we went with five other National Lawyers Guild lawyers on a trip led by Sandy Levinson from the Center for Cuban Studies. And, you know, there are tremendous changes going on now in Cuba. We want to talk about and share with you what we saw when we went down there.
We'll talk with Catherine Franke about last week's oral arguments on the gay marriage issue before the Supreme Court.
It's an elemental human right, the right for people to be treated equally. Will the Supreme Court step up to the plate? I doubt it.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the National Lawyers Guild.
And I'm Michael Ratner, president emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
Michael, I went to the Metropolitan Museum of Art last Sunday, and I knew that there was a suggested donation price. I was quite shocked to see that it was $25. And I'd read about the issue and felt a little shy about wanting to pay less, which I actually did, with the encouragement of a friend. But I noticed their signage doesn't make it that clear that this is not a mandatory donation.
Well, that very issue, Heidi, is in litigation as we speak. I was there last month with my family, and I was taken aback, too, because it would have cost us $100 if we didn't look at it closely. There's a sign up there that says $25 suggested.
But the suggested is tiny.
Right. And the lawsuit says that the public is being duped.
Isn't there an agreement when they founded these museums that they weren't going to have mandatory prices?
That was right, and that people would be allowed to pay anything they wanted. I think initially it was that people would be allowed to come in for free, and then that was changed back in the 70s to say they could pay anything they wanted. They just had to give something, you know, like a nickel. But when you go in there now, it says $25 suggested, and what the lawsuit has uncovered in discovery is that the museum conspired to figure out what kind of language to use to get the most money out of these unsuspecting tourist dupes.
They did market research.
And they used to use the word $25 recommended, but they thought that suggested was a stronger word.
It is. So it this stopped me in my tracks.
Well, it really gave me pause, too, and it annoyed me because public art should be just that. This is the great cumulative treasure of humanity, and it's on display there, and anybody that wants to see it should have free access to it.
But guess what, Michael? What? They not only have changed that word, I don't know if you saw it when you were there, but they now have an additional display that says this is why it's so important that you pay, and it has more promotional materials right in front, a foot away from that sign.
That's disgusting. And you know why it's disgusting? Because the Metropolitan Museum of Art has an endowment of $282 billion. That's more than the gross national product of a number of countries.
Stunning. Well, did you enjoy the exhibit anyway?
Yes. On March 24th, attorney Dennis James and I and three other National Lawyers Guild members returned from Cuba on a trip led by the Center for Cuban Studies. Dennis is a civil rights lawyer, formerly of Detroit, now living in Brooklyn, and a former executive director of the National Lawyers Guild. We went with our companions to appreciate the fundamental changes now going on in Cuban law with respect to travel, home, car, and business ownership, and the possibilities that all this opens up for a rejuvenation of the Cuban economy. Dennis James, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you, Mike.
Our listeners should know that Dennis and I have been friends for 43 years. We were law partners. We had a movement law firm in Detroit. Dennis is a civil rights lawyer from Detroit, now living in Brooklyn. And Dennis and I and five other lawyers just got back from a 10-day trip to Cuba got back on March 24th. We went with our companions. We toured Havana and then Santiago and some other cities as well. We were there to investigate the changes that are going on in Cuba. That's what we're going to talk about today. And we also were able to see a lot of Cuban art, which is amazing. Dennis, welcome to Law and Disorder. What were your strongest impressions upon coming back from the island?
The impression of the people being very, having very strong identification with the revolution that they made. The fact that Cuba is theirs and that nobody else is going to tell them how to run it. They have a lot of complaints about shortages and not being able to live the life of the 1% of 1%, but they are very appreciative of the basic needs of life that are provided for.
Rent is free there. There's a social safety net so that there's food, although it's rationed. There's not steak for everybody every night, but people get minimal nutrition. School is free up through college. Transportation is very cheap. Healthcare is free for everybody. So there's a certain social safety net there, even though it's a poor country, it's an island, and it's been under a constant economic blockade by the United States since 1960. That being said, it's a different kind of society, and that was what was so fascinating when we went around. Let's talk about that school of music and dance that we went to in Santiago, you know, the second biggest city in Cuba, a million
right.
people on the East Coast.
Right.
Remember when we walked in there? The first two kids, one of them played a flute and played a piece by a Handel. Another one played the saxophone. But then four girls about 10, 12 years old came out. One of them took the piano, and they started singing. What?
Give me that old-time religion.
It was hysterical. Evidently, they like American spirituals.
Right.
But what impressed me was that children were all in different color uniforms, depending on what age they were, very attentive to each other and kind of kind to each other, looked, like happy children.
Yeah, it was an amazing place. It was, elementary, our equivalent of elementary and high school. The staff was great, and they put on extraordinary dance performances for us.
That was amazing.
We watched classes. And every color of the rainbow, that is in the shades of brown and black, every different kind of kid you can think of. And they just did all kinds of dance that were just joyous. And, of course, they dragged us onto the floor to make fools of ourselves at the end of it. But they had a hell of a time doing it, and so did we. My knee will never be the same.
Let's talk about the legal changes that have gone on in the last several months in Cuba. As you know, Dennis, people can now buy and sell housing.
Right.
They can buy and sell cars.
Right.
They can set up their own small businesses.
Right.
They're free to travel, get a visa from another country. You can go and stay and come back a year or 2 years. The place is changing very dramatically. These changes are extraordinary and fundamental. What brought them about, Dennis?
The government did a thorough and very multi-level canvassing of the population through its National Assembly and through the Committees for Defense of the Revolution that polled the people as to how they felt about certain proposals in terms of changing the economy, what it is they wanted, what it is they didn't want. Just talking to the people, many people on the street, they remember this process that went on, and they conveyed their sentiments and their needs to the government, and the government undertook to move in the direction of releasing some of the productive capacity to what we would call private enterprise, they call self-employment, and to allowing some development of private businesses while retaining an overall socialist structure.
Well, that the high levels of the economy, the banking, say, and foreign trade, will still be under the control of the government.
Right.
But at levels below that, I think it's something like a million people are now, in some sense, on their own,
right.
like a barber
right.
or restaurant workers.
Right.
They're going to have to carve out a spot in the economy.
Right.
But there's no law written that a socialist economy has to be a top-down structure with planning from the top, no market mechanisms. That kind of structure, which was brought in by the Soviet Union, didn't work. And that society was really at a halt.
Yeah.
And something had to be done, and this was what was done.
Yeah, it's essentially a very pragmatic approach, a very unique approach. They have a unique situation down there. They're moving cautiously into a development of private enterprise, making sure that there isn't any super exploitation, and having confidence in the people's ingenuity and enterprise in this area. The government kind of watches and sees what enterprises seem to make sense, which ones are succeeding, and the ones that are succeeding and pay their taxes and employ people are encouraged.
This was all necessitated because Cuba does not have a normal relationship with the world. Its giant neighbor to the north has blockaded it since 1960. That story is interesting because the Cubans hadn't intended after the 1959 revolution to do what they did, but they had to take certain control over their destiny. And the second law, the first law that the Cuban revolutionary government passed, was making Che Guevara, who was an Argentinian, making him a citizen. And the other law was to lower the age when somebody could serve in the government, because Fidel was 33, and he became the head of the government. Che was 31. It was a revolution made by young people. But the third law was the Great Agrarian Reform Law, and this is what really aggravated the American government and corporations, because most of the land in Cuba was owned by big American corporations, and it was worked by poor Cuban peasants who were seasonally employed, illiterate, ill-dressed, ill-fed, and those were the people that supported and made the Cuban Revolution. So the third law was to give that American land to these poor peasants.
Right.
And that's what caused the United States to say, we're no longer going to refine your oil in our refinery. So the Cuban economy had no gasoline.
Right.
So what did they do? They nationalized the refinery.
Right.
Then they nationalized the phone company. Then they nationalized the nickel mines. Then they nationalized more of the agriculture, and on and on. And that kind of nationalization of what had been American property is what we know as the Cuban Socialist Revolution. And that's why the United States has blockaded Cuba for the last 60-some years.
Sure, of course. The United States would like nothing better than to reinstate that prior economic system, which was exploitative and colonizing. Interesting point was they complained that this had all been done without compensation. But the Cuban government had, in fact, offered compensation to these various mega enterprises using the evaluation that they had put on themselves in the last taxation of their property, which of course they all grossly undervalued. So they raised a lot of stink about that, but they couldn't very well get out from under. The thing that's amazing is the adaptability of the Cuban Revolution over the years, after taking some incredibly hard knocks. I mean, having been invaded, having assassination attempts by the hundreds against their leadership, having to maintain a standing army to fend off the world's greatest superpower, which have had it in its crosshairs ever since 1959.
Even before 59, you know, the United States supported and supplied the dictator Batista, who the Cuban revolutionaries were fighting against, and that war cost the lives of 50,000 Cubans. So even before 59, and certainly since then.
Right, right. Not to mention the gold that Batista transported when he fled to Spain after things got too hot for him. And during this time, to at the same time take care of the basic needs of its people in terms of life expectancy, infant mortality, literacy, in which they rank first in the hemisphere, exceeding even that of the United States, not to mention the rest of Latin America. To have that kind of social contract that they have satisfied with the people is just amazing under these adverse conditions.
There was a buzz about a book that's just been published in Spanish by the Cubans. It's also available in English, called The Man Who Loved Dogs. Mm-hmm. And it's by a well-known Cuban author named Leonardo Padura, P-A-D-U-R-A. And it was interesting, when we met with Pepe Viero, the former diplomat here in the United States, he was at the Cuban mission, and our guide was talking about it, and I met with one of the heads of the Cuban National Publishing House, and he was talking about it. So I ordered the book, and I've been reading about it. It's quite interesting. The Man Who Loved Dogs is a Cuban. There are two other central figures in the book. One of them is the assassin of Leon Trotsky, and the other is Trotsky, those three characters. And why would a book like this be written? Well, the Cubans are trying to figure out what happened to them when the Soviets came in and guided the economy, and they had that kind of top-down economic organization, very kind of rigid enforcement in the Communist Party, and they're still recoiling from that experience, and they're wondering, where did it come from? And they're figuring out, historically, where did it come from? It came from what happened to the Soviet Union. It came from the rise of Stalin and what he represented in terms of a privileged bureaucracy in Russia and the really decline of the Soviet Union. I remember when Michael Ratner and I did our book on how the CIA assassinated Che, we have a piece in there about when Che went over to the Soviet Union, and he was appalled at the way the bureaucracy lived in this luscious, elegant way, and he went on to Algeria, and he made a famous speech in Algeria about how the Russians weren't adequately supporting the Vietnamese during their revolution, and how they were doling out support with an eyedropper, and how they really weren't internationalists. And the Russians, for their part, were grumbling about Che, and they had some respect for him, but they said, you know, he reminds us of Trotsky, you know, the revolutionary. Mm-hmm. So all this history from the 20s and that big struggle in Russia that took place between those who wanted to continue the Russian Revolution and those who wanted to just profit by it, that was the origins of the party in Russia that then came to have relations with Cuba. And it was a disaster in a couple of ways. One way was a disaster in that the economy wasn't organized in a democratic way the way they're trying to do it now. But secondly, it was a disaster when the Soviet Union folded. So they're trying to figure out, why did the Soviet Union go under? Why were they like what they were when they were here? And this book, The Man Who Loved Dogs, tries to tell that story. And the Cubans are now reading it.
Right. I wanted to briefly call attention to another book for people who are interested in you know, verifying a lot of the factual things that Mike and I have been talking about, or just want to know a systematic development of modern Cuba. It's called Cuba, What Everyone Needs to Know by Julia Sweig, S-W-E-I-G, published by Oxford University Press. She was an analyst for the Council on Foreign Relations, not exactly a left-wing organization, very, very much establishment. But she wrote a very factual history that's very well organized, not academically esoteric. You know, she doesn't do a lot of political judgment in it. She mostly just relates the facts as to what's happened. And I think it would be an eye-opener for a lot of people who are fed the diet of what's in the New York Times, among other media that we have.
I'm holding in my hands the March 24th issue of the Sunday Times, the day we got back, and there was an article called "For Blacks in Cuba, the Revolution Hasn't Begun." And the essence of the article is just that, that the revolution hasn't really had much of an effect on blacks in Cuba. And it's written by a man named Roberto Zurbano. The article is really fundamentally dishonest. It doesn't even mention the blockade. And it reminded me of that old joke about how Cuba is treated in the American media. And it has to do with when the Pope first came on his trip to Cuba, and he was riding in his Pope-mobile with Fidel Castro, and they're riding along the Malecón, that strip of a highway that goes along the coast of the Atlantic by Havana. And they're riding along the street, and the wind picks up, and the Pope's skull cap is lifted off his hat and blown out into the water. So Fidel instructs the driver to stop the Pope mobile, which he does. The Pope gets out of the car, hops over the fence, walks across the sandy beach, walks out to the shore, and then he proceeds to walk on top of the water to the skull cap, picks it up, turns around, walks back across the water, across the beach, over the fence, back into the Pope mobile, and he places the skull cap back on Papa's head. Mm-hmm. Well, the way this story was reported is as follows. In Prensa Latina, the newspaper of the Cuban government, it was reported pretty much as I just described it. In La Observatoire Romano, the newspaper of the Vatican, the headline was, God allows Castro to perform a miracle. And in the Miami Herald, the newspaper of the Cuban counter-revolutionaries, and like the New York Times, it was reported as follows. Castro, too old to swim. And that's the nature of this article for Blacks in Cuba, The Revolution Hasn't Begun. That certainly wasn't my impression from being there this time or three other times. For example, Zurbano, who wrote this article, doesn't report that the head of the Cuban trade unions is black or the new head of the parliament is black. When we were out at that neighborhood meeting, I met two black women, both of whom were philosophy professors at a university. And there's just all sorts of anecdotal evidence that it's just not so. Are black people in Cuba in worse shape than whites? Certainly. They inherited a racist country. Right. Cuba didn't abolish slavery till after the United States.
Right, right. There's very little context provided for his comments, which are inaccurate to begin with. Cuba was so color conscious just before the revolution that even Batista couldn't get into the most exclusive country club because he was a couple of shades too dark.
They wouldn't let him into the yacht club.
They wouldn't let
him
in.
He was the dictator.
So these people, you know, white rich people move to Miami and they send back remittances to relatives, and that perpetuates the privileged position of people of a whiter skin color. But the government works actively against this. And particularly among the young people, we just saw all colors of cafe au lait to espresso among the kids, and there seemed to be no problem. In terms of the arts, which was the focus of, besides politics, of our trip, there were many indications of the support of the arts among even the poorest people, people who work in the sugar mills. There's a town called, was it Mele?
Yeah.
I think it's called, where there has developed a whole colony of people who practice what they call naive art. I think it's naive in just in the sense that it's self-taught.
Yeah.
And they do wonderful paintings. These are regular workers, doctors, lawyers, sugar mill.
Bus driver, a cop.
Bakers, a cop, sugar mill workers. We went out there. Their work is encouraged. It's given exhibits in Havana. It was really beautiful stuff.
Beautiful stuff. You know, we didn't mention that the leader of our trip was Sandy Levinson, who is the head of the Center for Cuban Studies, and she has an art gallery for Cuban art down in Chelsea. I think it's on 29th Street, the Center for Cuban Studies. And if people are interested in it, Cuban art is fantastic. There's been an explosion of artistic creativity in Cuba since the revolution. And Sandy has brought back a lot of this art and represents a lot of the artists over there, both the self-taught artists and the classical artists. And if you want to get an inkling, because you can't really describe art, mm-hmm. Go over to Sandy's gallery at the Center for Cuban Studies, or look it up online, because those paintings and sculptures are photographed and they're online. The Center for Cuban Studies.
Yeah, Cuban art is very big on the continent, in Europe, I should say. It really should catch on here. It's very exuberant. A lot of it is very socially critical. We're not talking about flag waving, hammer and sickle brandishing socialist realism of China and Russia. We're talking about just wonderful expressions of culture.
I thought another high point, Dennis, was when we visited that neighborhood in Santiago and met with neighbors who had come out to welcome us, all in the Committee for the Defense of the Revolution. And they talked about, well, a couple of the children read poems by Jose Marti, who is their national hero, and then asked us about the Cuban Five, who have wide, wide support in Cuba. And in America, hardly anybody knows who they are.
Correct.
Who are they? I'll tell you. I think listeners to our show know, but if you're tuning in for the first time or haven't heard a program on it, the Cuban Five, are four of them are still in prison in the United States serving long terms, one of them two life terms. Why? Because after the Soviet Union pulled out of Cuba in 1991, the Cuban economy was just a disaster. They had lost their lifeline, their oil, for example. People lost weight. Our guide told us that he had lost something like 30 pounds. There were scarcities everywhere. People got to work 10 miles riding bikes. It was just a very terrible period. And the Cuban government figured that what resource do they have? Well, they've got more beautiful beaches in Cuba than all the beaches combined in all of the Caribbean. And they should develop their tourist industry. So they went in partnerships with European firms, particularly Spanish ones, and they built hotels, and they encouraged tourists from Europe and Canada, because you can't go there if you're from the United States. You just can't go there and go to the beach. But they encouraged tourists to come, which they did, and the counter-revolutionaries centered in Miami sought to disrupt that flow of tourism to Cuba. What did they do? They planted bombs on buses coming from the airport. They planted bombs in hotels. One of them that was organized by Jose Posada Carrillas killed an Italian tourist. They tried to discourage tourism. And the Cubans appealed to the FBI in America. They had sent a number of people from the Cuban intelligence services into Miami to infiltrate these Cuban counter-revolutionary groups that were committing violence against property and people in Havana. And they compiled a huge dossier on who these people were and what they were doing. And they met with the FBI. The number two guy, I think, from the FBI went down to Cuba, and they presented him with this dossier, and they said, please help us. I mean, for one thing, it's illegal to launch armed attacks against us from the United States. It violates the Neutrality Act. But we need your help and cooperation, and will you please arrest these people that are doing this? Well, what did the United States government do? It betrayed the Cubans. It gave the dossier over to their analysts. They figured out who the Cuban agents were in the United States, and they arrested them. They charged them with conspiracy to commit espionage sometime in the future, which is like a thought crime, but which is something that you could sell to a counter-revolutionary jury of Cuban Americans in Miami. So the lawyers made a motion to transfer venue out of Miami, which should have been routinely granted. The judge turned down the motion. The trial went on for 9 months. It was the longest trial up to that time in the history of America. And the Cubans were quickly convicted of the conspiracy to commit espionage sometime in the future and put in prison. Well, at that point, our friend Len Weinglass came in, wrote the brief. They took an appeal, and they won the appeal. They had a panel of three judges, two of whom said, you didn't get a fair trial. You couldn't possibly get a fair trial in Miami. I mean, that city's got its own foreign policy.
Right.
You know? And what did the government do? It appealed that to en banc, the entire circuit court. It was overturned. So the Cuban Five are still in prison. We had a program on last week with Marty Garbus, who's replaced Len Weinglass as one of the attorneys on the team, and they're making a motion now because there were paid journalists influencing the jury, and you're not supposed to do that. So it's on appeal, but the Cuban Five still sit in jail. There's a massive campaign in Cuba to popularize their plight and to try to get help, and it was very touching in that neighborhood when people reached out to us, and we promised them that we would talk about that on our show.
Right. I should be pointed out that before taking the step of having to send intelligence agents into Florida to try to get the information as to what these assassins in Miami were doing and had done, Cuba repeatedly asked the United States to have the FBI, to have its law enforcement agencies investigate these people and come up with indictments themselves. And they were totally ignored. These murderers are those that haven't passed away through old age are walking around the streets of Miami.
On our tax money, retired.
On our tax money. These were people that were received training, financial support, USAID support, CIA support, and they're murderers. They have faced no punishment at all.
So what's the moral? It shows you the hypocrisy of the American so-called war on terror.
Right.
I met with Fernando Belles, who at one time had been at the Cuban interest section in Washington, D.C., and was kicked out of the country as a persona non grata and went down to Chile. When his tour of duty as a Cuban diplomat ended, he became one of the heads of the Cuban Book Institute, which is their national publishing house. And he brought good news to me and Michael Ratner. You know, we did a book called Who Killed Che? How the CIA Got Away with Murder. And that book is now been translated into Spanish by the Cuban publishing house. It'll be published in September. And they asked us to come back for the Havana Book Fair in February. The book is going to sell for just a couple of pesos so that everybody in Cuba will be able to buy it. We're very pleased because that was the reason that we wrote the book. We wanted it to come out in Spanish, and indeed it's going to be available in Cuba this fall.
That's a good point to make. I just hope that anybody who listens to this gets involved in that cause. It's gone on the back burner in terms of this administration and in terms of the media. It shouldn't be. It should be out in front. It's a gross injustice. It should be remedied.
With that final plea, Dennis, Dennis James, I want to thank you very much for being on the show and do a shout out to Sandy Levinson from the Center for Cuban Studies, who does such great work, and invite you people to come down to her art gallery at the Center for Cuban Studies. Thanks, Dennis.
Thank you, Mike.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
Last week, the U.S. Supreme Court heard oral arguments on two historic cases that could establish the constitutional right of gay marriage. The first case, Hollingsworth v. Perry, is a challenge to Proposition 8, the California 2008 voter-approved ban on same-sex unions. 6 months after the California Supreme Court endorsed gay marriage, voters passed Proposition 8, which amended the state's constitution to only recognize marriages between a man and a woman. Lower federal courts have declared the gay marriage ban to be unconstitutional, and now it went up to the Supreme Court. The second case the U.S. Supreme Court heard was a challenge to the 1996 Defense of Marriage Act. This act bars married gay couples from receiving federal marriage benefits, such as Social Security or family medical leave. To talk more about these cases, we're joined by Professor Catherine Franke, the director of the Center for Gender and Sexual Law at Columbia Law School and a professor there at the law school.
Catherine Franke, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Oh, thank you so much.
Well, last week the Supreme Court heard oral arguments in two gay marriage cases, one related to DOMA and the other related to Proposition 8 in California. We wanted to start by asking, if you were a justice on the Supreme Court, how would you rule on each and why?
Wow, that's such an interesting question.
Let's start with Proposition 8, the one out in California where voters overruled gay marriage, and the case is now at the Supreme Court, and you're sitting there. What would you do?
On the Prop 8 case?
Yeah.
I would likely certainly question the issue of standing, which the court is, from their argument, also taking quite seriously. The law of standing doesn't always sound like a very sexy or civil rightsy sort of topic, but it's actually an incredibly important issue in civil rights law and in law where groups of people want to assert a kind of interest in an overarching public issue like the right to marry. And given that the court is so focused on the standing issue, I'm concerned that they will, in this case, create a new, more narrow rule for groups like public interest groups like the Center for Constitutional Rights or the ACLU or other groups to assert interests on behalf of a large group of people in cases like this. So the standing issue I'm not insensitive to. I think it's really important. But I think the larger issue, the underlying substantive issue, is obviously has to do with the right of Californians to marry. And I actually am of the view that this case should never have been brought. There's been a great tension between David Boies and Ten Olson on the one hand and the movement lawyers on the other. And the movement lawyers really argued for Boies and Olson not to bring the case. And Boies and Olson actually lobbied quite hard to keep the movement lawyers out of the case. So I agree to some degree with the court that this case is there too soon. When the law gets out ahead and the lawyers get out ahead of the movements that support them, often we do more damage than good when we get to the Supreme Court too soon.
Could you elaborate a bit on that, Catherine, because I think that's important. What would be the benefits of waiting? What could the movement do?
Well, you know, we have movement lawyers in the lesbian and gay community, and of course they don't all agree with each other. It's a complicated movement. But there's been a sense that they were going to go state by state, sort of pick off the states where they felt like they could start to build legal consensus around the issue of marriage rights and around a set of arguments that weren't going to hurt gay and lesbian people who didn't marry. And Boies and Olson, I'll say a little bit about that in a minute, but Boies and Olson decided that they were the smartest guys in the room and that they would do a better job of raising the issue of marriage than the movement lawyers have. And the difference between their approach and the lesbian and gay movement lawyers is that Boies and Olson care about marriage. They're carrying a brief for marriage. They're not carrying a brief for a community who have a diverse set of interests, marriage being only one of them. So, for instance, they pushed very hard in the trial court and also in their appellate briefs, Boies and Olson did, on an argument that it's actually in the best interests of children that their parents be married. More successful parents are parents who marry. Meanwhile, Lambda and ACLU lawyers are making arguments in other states where gay people can't marry, that there's nothing wrong with them as parents, that they're just fine parents, even though they can't marry. There are many situations where there are single parents who are absolutely fine parents. And this is an issue that radiates out from the gay community to all sorts of communities of color as well, that I think share an interest in how this case comes out. So Boies and Olson actually have a pretty conservative agenda that's about marriage rights, not about thinking about alternative forms of family and the ways in which the exclusion of same-sex couples from marriage is a way that the society enunciates a hatred of gay people rather than our embracing marriage as an overarching and important value.
Catherine, what was Olson's background?
Cat Olson's background? Well, he's been married a number of times.
That's funny.
he likes marriage a lot. As you know, he's a conservative and represented George Bush in the Bush versus Gore litigation. And that's part of what's made this legal team so sensationally interesting in the media is that you've got David Boies on the one hand, who's sort of the Democratic Party's official lawyer, and then you've got Ted Olson on the other, who is a somewhat libertarian sort of conservative who was represented the Republican Party, but has also appeared in the Supreme Court quite often. But I must say, he did a pretty miserable job in the Ninth Circuit defending the Perry decision. So simply because you've got a lot of experience as an appellate lawyer doesn't mean you can just jump in and take over complex arguments like the ones that are at stake in the marriage cases and do as good a job with those as you might have for George Bush when he basically stole the election the first time he served in office.
Let's turn to the DOMA case for a minute. What's at stake here?
Well, the DOMA, the two cases raise very different issues.
What does DOMA mean?
The Defense of Marriage Act is a law that, unfortunately, President Clinton signed in 1996, and it was basically a homophobic cry from the Congress to limit on the federal level any definition of marriage to a marriage between a man and a woman. So there are thousands of ways in which being married gives you benefits, but also burdens or responsibilities under federal law. So from tax status to who can have special treatment under our immigration laws through the family reunification process, the ability to inherit Social Security benefits, all sorts of things turn on whether you're married. And then if you're a federal employee, if you're married, you can put your spouse and your dependent children on your health insurance. If you're not married, you can't. So there are ways in which unmarried couples are paid less than married couples are and on the federal level. So the Defense of Marriage Act said two important things. One is that for the purpose of any federal law, the only kind of marriage federal law will recognize is marriage between a man and a woman, notwithstanding whether states might go ahead and marry same-sex couples like we do in New York. The federal government won't recognize those marriages. The second thing the Defense of Marriage Act said is that no state is under any obligation to recognize another state's change in law that allows same-sex couples to marry. This is not at issue in the DOMA case. They've only challenged the federal definition of marriage, but it is an additional part of the law that is problematic. So Edie Windsor is the plaintiff in the DOMA case. She's now elderly, but when her partner of many, many years passed away, Edie inherited under the will her partner's property that they had jointly owned together. And under federal tax law, it's as if they were strangers to one another. So Edie had to pay about $360,000 in inheritance taxes for the property that she had owned with her partner. Had they been married, legally married, according to a federal definition of marriage, in that sense, had Edie's partner been a man, she would not have had to pay these federal income taxes. So the issue in the DOMA case raises the injustice of having to pay federal taxes when you're married to a same-sex partner as opposed to a different-sex partner.
Catherine, I wanted to ask you about the number of amicus or friend of the court briefs that were filed in these cases. I think sometimes that's a barometer of public interest. Were there many briefs filed?
Oh, there were many, many briefs. It's not unusual for a Supreme Court case like this, particularly one that's garnered so much public attention. And there are a number of briefs that you wouldn't have anticipated, say, a year ago. So there was a coalition of large corporations that filed a brief and said, actually, it's bad for business that the Defense of Marriage Act is in place, because many employers like mine, I work at Columbia University, end up topping us off, if you will, but reimbursing us for the tax hit that we take on the federal level for insuring our spouses or partners. So my partner is on the health plan here at Columbia, and that counts under federal tax law as income to me. I were married to a man, I would not be taxed on that extra benefit of having my spouse on the health plan. And so Columbia, like a number of corporations, has decided as a matter of equity to reimburse us for that tax hit. So it costs money to good guy companies to try to equalize the injustice of having to pay taxes when you're in a same-sex relationship as opposed to a different-sex relationship. So that's one set of briefs. Then you've got Republican members of Congress who have submitted briefs supporting the overturning of DOMA. And so you've seen that the political alignment around this issue has really shifted at a rapid pace in the last year. And many of us felt that that to be on the right side of history, you really had to oppose the limitations on same-sex couples to marry. The arguments over the last week actually didn't seem to reflect what we all thought was a sort of a fact of the matter now, which is that it was obvious that limiting marriage to different-sex couples was wrong, because the court was much more skeptical than we expected.
In terms of the standing issue on the DOMA case, do you have the same opinion about that as you do with Proposition 8-1?
I don't. There are standing issues in the DOMA case, but I think that the standing issue is an easier one for the court to decide. And the underlying constitutional problem is more ripe in the DOMA context than it is in the Prop 8 context. There's some very quirky things about the way that the Prop 8 case was litigated and decided that actually might justify limiting the ruling just to California or just to that by sending it back to the courts there. But the DOMA case is as ripe as that can be. Either it's unconstitutional or it isn't. And I think the court could certainly legitimately see the issue was before them properly.
We can count on them for doing bold things, putting Bush in office, allowing corporations to give as much money as they want to political parties. And I imagine in the face of public opinion, I read a Pew poll recently that said that 81% of American people under the age of 30 support gay marriage. So I think it's something that's overwhelmingly popular, particularly amongst young people. But given that, I think we can count on the Supreme Court to not allow it. And I'm very skeptical that they're going to do the right thing on Proposition 8. And my suspicion is that they're going to duck from the issue and say it's a standing issue and not rule on it. What do you think?
That may be right. You know, before we had the argument, there was lots of speculation among those of us who care deeply about this issue about why the court took the standing issues in both the cases as well as the underlying really substantive question of a right to marry. And a lot of the speculation turned on, well, which arm of the court, was it the liberals or the conservatives, that were pushing for the standing issue to be before the court? Because it wasn't briefed and raised by the parties, at least in one of the cases. And what we learned in the Prop 8 argument last Tuesday is that it was the conservatives that were pushing for the standing issue, four of them. And probably four of the liberals didn't want to take the case. And then, of course, there's always Justice Kennedy. And he's the one to which everybody is pitching their arguments because they need his vote. And he even signaled that what he may want to do is just dismiss the case as being untimely and not ripe enough as it is. So the standing issue seems to be the hook that the conservatives used to get the case before the court. But you only need four votes to accept the case. You need five votes to get an opinion once they've heard the case. And it's not obvious that they're going to have five votes on the merits of the issue in either of those cases.
So you think the conservatives wanted to get it before the court and then rule that Prop 8 is okay, keep gay marriage outlawed? That was their game plan?
Or to issue a rather narrow or, from the perspective of the left, problematic ruling on standing, which, as I said earlier, is an extremely important issue for civil rights lawyers.
And the four liberal justices, what do you think they were trying to do?
Well, Justice Ginsburg was here last year at a forum that I put together, and she expressed a view on the abortion cases that I think was partly tipping her hand on the marriage cases. And when talking about Roe and the abortion cases earlier in her career, she said she was worried that Roe made its way to the court too soon, that it was actually out ahead of the social movements that were on the ground working to organize and mobilize around women's reproductive rights, and that she kind of wished that the case had come to them a little bit later. And then that was in part a way to explain the backlash or the lack of traction that Roe has gotten as a constitutional principle that we're still fighting today. I think some of the other members of the more liberal wing of the court have that view about the marriage case. It's just gotten to the court too soon. And they would rather that the issue were knocked around in state legislatures, in popular opinion, in politics, in the media, a bit more before it gets to the court, because the court really doesn't want to be too far out ahead of where the people are.
Catherine Frankie, we just have a few minutes left, but I would like to hear, if you don't mind, just a brief description of what you're doing at Columbia.
Ah, well, thank you so much for asking. I direct our Center on Gender and Sexuality Law. In addition to teaching a number of courses, some of which have to do with gender and sexuality, some of which don't, I'm actually now teaching for the first time a class on the law of occupation. So we're looking at Iraq and Palestine and the United States, Puerto Rico, Hawaii, and places like that to understand whether the law can actually be a force for good when military forces like the Israelis or like the Americans occupy another sovereign state. But among the things we do here at our center is we've got a really great new project, Engaging Tradition, and thinking about arguments based in tradition that have been used traditionally to undermine gender or sexuality-based justice claims. Those issues come up in the marriage context all over the place. And then I'm doing quite a bit of work on religious exemptions. This is also a new trend as a way to undermine the right to contraception, the right to abortion, the right to just basic health care, and sexual and reproductive rights more generally.
Three subjects that we'd love to have you back on to talk about. We've done a little bit with issues of gender stereotypes in elementary school classes, so we've touched on that to a small degree.
Great.
Well, we'll be watching the newspapers, as I'm sure you will, and it was a pleasure to have you on, Catherine.
Thank you so much. My pleasure as well.
Thank you, Catherine.
All right.
Yeah, take
Bye-bye.
It easy.
You too. Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.
Crying out for justice. Everyone is crying out for peace, yes. None is crying out for justice. I don't want no peace. I need equal rights and justice.
Justice. I've got to get equal. justice, and there'll be no crime.
Equal rights
and justice, there'll be no criminals.
Equal rights
and justice, everyone is fighting for
equal rights
and justice. Palestinians fighting for
equal rights
and justice down in Angola. Down in Rhodesia.